come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
We was getting too big for our bitches.
Excellent day for an exorcism.
What have you done to its eyes?
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Biddy well, little brother. Biddy well.
Hello and welcome, listeners, to episode number 98 of Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here of David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. And on this episode here, I'm going to have another of those Odyssey of the Ones episodes for you. This is going to be number 24. As I have a little mad scientist, science fiction type double feature here of horror films with The Son of Dr. Jekyll from 1951 and Dynamic from here in 2021. And also on this episode, I have mini reviews of Malignant, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, Housebound, and Goodnight Mommy, as I'm almost done with the 2014 list for the summer series. Just have one more to watch there. So I don't really think there's anything else I need to get up to speed with here on this episode. I think this is pretty standard for what I'm doing. So what I'm going to go ahead and do is get you over to a very brief break before I get into those mini reviews. And I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me. And for my first mini review this week is going to be Malignant. This is from 2021. This is directed by James Wan, who also helped come up with a story along with Ingrid Bisou and Akila Cooper. And Cooper also wrote the screenplay. This stars Annabelle Wallace, Maddie Hassan, and George Young. This is an action crime horror mystery thriller film that is a co-production between the United States and China. This is currently sitting on a 6.3 on IMDb and a 3.2 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being Madison is paralyzed by shocking visions of grisly murders, and her torment worsens as she discovers that these waking dreams are in fact terrifying realities. So this is a movie that I saw the poster for when I went to the theater. From there, I had heard some buzz about it being the new James Wan film that was in horror. It might also had giallo vibes as well as from what other people were talking about. And regardless, I like to support horror, so this went on a list for me to check out, and Jamie and I ended up watching this after she saw the trailer and thought it was interesting. So what I'm going to do here is not go into spoilers since this is, you know, a new film, but I did avoid reading or hearing what people thought about this before I got the chance to check it out. Now, right afterwards, I did hear a podcast before writing this, which was on the Patreon for Horror in the House of Salmons. Now, what I'm glad is that Jamie over there made a connection about one movie from the past, while Brian made another one that I didn't even think of, but it makes a whole lot of sense after I heard what he said. But I'm going to avoid, again, spoilers, but this is something I should just preface here. Now, where I want to start is that the title itself. I knew that this would have to do something with, you know, being medical coming in. It doesn't come as a shock with the cold open or the opening credits. What they do with this is quite interesting. It is taking something we've seen before in horror, but I think they do something a bit different here that I enjoyed quite a bit. Now, I did tell Jamie a major reveal early on that I just picked up on, and I end up being right to an extent. I told her that if it would have been dead on from that get-go, it would have hurt the overall product for me. Since they added in enough to it, I appreciate the truth of our killer. It even explains how things with this, and it moves and, you know, acts and everything like that. Now, I want to delve into something else that I've heard. Wan states that this is his take on giallo. I only get that from the lighting of the movie and a little bit from the music. Now, the lighting does harken back to things like Mario Bava or Argento. The killer does wear black gloves and it's a mystery as to who they are. Now, even our character of Madison or her sister of Sydney trying to solve who the killer is something very giallo-like. For me, though, this is more of a slasher film. I would loosely give it the term of a neo-giallo just because of some of those other elements. Not that that really necessarily matters, but just my thoughts on this whole idea here. Now, since I'm going to avoid spoilers, I'll move us next to the effects and cinematography. For the former, I think that they are good for the most part. We get blood and the attacks are violent. There are even some good effects with our killer being played at times by a contortionist of Troy James. Everything that they did practically looked good to me. There is some CGI. This, I'll be honest, is a little bit hit or miss for me. I think that there are some things that are good, like the transitions from Madison as she gets to see what Gabriel is doing. Some of the action scenes, though, were a bit much for me. This bleeds into the cinematography as well. Now, Juan does an excellent job with how this was shot. There are just some things done with action sequences that turn me off to the movie. I understand that our killer is supernatural, but also being grounded in reality. Some of the things that we see, I couldn't suspend enough disbelief, though. I'm still positive on these parts of the movie, though, overall. So this will then take me to the acting. I thought that Wallace was solid as our lead here. I like that she is torn between what is happening around her, but she cannot explain it. She does things that make her a suspect, and that is real for me. Hassan was solid as her sister, who no matter what loves her and wants to help. Young is good along with Nicole Brianna White. I think they play off each other well as our detectives. I thought the rest of the cast was solid for what was needed to round us out and direct our characters to where they have to go. But I did want to shout out here to Zoe Bell and McKenna Grace and their cameos. I also saw the combination of Ray Chase, Mariana Mespa, and James were all good as Gabriel as well. So that in conclusion here, I thought this movie was solid. There was buzz, so I was excited to see this, and I think that this movie lived up to the expectations that I tried not to have, but ultimately had a bit of. We have an interesting story here that is blending slasher elements with a bit of giallo and even a medical-style movie. The acting was solid, the majority of the effects were as well, and the same could be said for the cinematography. The soundtrack I thought worked for the most part. I also like the elements that were incorporated into this movie from other horror films, while still doing their own things with it. For me, I would say this is a good movie and one of the better of the year. This is going to be another one that I want to rewatch before the end of year as well. So my rating here for Malignant is going to be an 8 out of 10. And I also got to watch A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. This is from 2014. This was written and directed by Anna Lily Amanpour. This stars Sheila Vand, Arash Marandi, and Marshall Manesh. This is a drama, horror, romance, thriller film that is from the United States. This is currently sitting on a 7.0 on IMDb and a 3.7 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, in the Iranian ghost town Bad City, a place that reeks of death and loneliness, the townspeople are unaware that they're being stalked by a lonesome vampire. So I originally had heard about this film through podcasts, but I didn't know too much coming in originally. I decided to give this a viewing originally as part of one of my 31 days of Halloween challenge. I am now giving it a second viewing as part of the podcast Under the Stairs for the summer series. So where I want to start is that this film isn't for everyone. It is a slow burn and not necessarily a whole lot happens. What pulled me in though is the plight of all of the characters. There is a line about how only idiots and the rich think that their lives can change. This hit home for me and it's kind of scary. There are a lot of allegories for these from what I saw as well. Now, the character of Saeed, who is a pimp as well as a drug dealer, thinks he's a predator as he has tigers on everything, including tattoos. He discovers what a real predator is through this character of the girl. Now, the setting in this film was something that was pretty interesting as well. Much like the film Near Dark, it takes place in a desert where we have all these oil wells pumping. Being that this is a vampire film, that's an interesting parallel. And then going from that, we also get a scene where one of them stops working. The city is drying up, not only in oil, but also in blood. I did find this reoccurring image of a dried up riverbed with a bunch of bodies in it to be a little bit interesting. I get where the bodies come from, but the lack of realism there bothered me. But what I like is that this film is, you know, made in the United States, but they did a great job mimicking the Middle East, and, you know, that's where it's supposed to be taking place. So in the last part of the story I want to touch on would be the character of Arash, who is a hardworking guy. In the beginning, there's a boy that wants a handout, and he gives him advice of how many days he worked to buy the car that he has. Saeed just ends up taking the car from him, though, showing a bit here that nice guys don't always win. Now, once that character is killed, Arash decides to go the easier route of taking over for Saeed. We see that even though with all the money and the selling of the drugs that he gets from him, Arash's life isn't that much easier. Some things happen to him that make him fully free, or at least it seems to be. This area just isn't conducive through a good living for his plight, though, unfortunately. Now, what is more important here would be the acting. I really liked Vans and her performance. She doesn't have a whole lot of lines, but we see from everything that she is wearing on her that she does. This is interesting for a vampire film and for her being the creature. I liked bringing almost a human element to the creature. Mirandi was probably my favorite character, though, since I could connect with him. I have trouble at work where sometimes I work too hard and the employer ends up taking advantage of me. It was nice to see his hard work pay off, but it's also a cautionary tale that taking the easy road doesn't always mean that it is easy. And then Manesh is his father, and I felt bad for him as he's turned to drugs to overcome his grief, and he is a never-ending wheel there where he tries to get clean and then just ends up using, and he doesn't ever seem to be able to break out of it. I also felt bad for the character of Mozan Marno, who is Adi the prostitute. She so badly wants to get out, but she's not a whole lot that she can do. And I also wanted to give credit here to Dominic Reigns, who is Saeed the pimp. And then we also have Rome Chandeladu, who is Shada, who is the rich girl as a princess. They're bad people to an extent, but I like the role they play for the film and the building of the story. And I thought the rest of the cast round this out for what was needed. So as for the effects, there aren't a lot of them. Much of the attacks are off-screen or blocked by the girl's cape. I didn't mind this, though, as it's done more practically. I did like the effect of her changing into a vampire where her fangs emerge. It happened so quickly and was effective. What is good, though, is the cinematography. I've already stated that this is filmed in black and white, which adds something to the movie. It is shot beautifully. Something else that I want to give credit here would be the score to the film. There are times when it gives the scene such a surreal feel, and it's interesting, though, is how bleak life is in this area. It ramps it up, and it involves the use of drugs, or the girl is there. Either way, I thought this was a good aspect to the movie. So now with that said, I enjoyed this film. It had a feel of The Transfiguration, which is another vampire movie that I enjoyed quite a bit as well. This film doesn't have the most complex story, but it does some great things with acting where the characters have complex backstories. Seeing how they interact in this rough place they call home was good. The film has a slow burn, but it is also, you know, that's not necessarily a problem. But if it is for you, I would avoid this one. Visually, this movie is really good, and it adds to it, you know, being shot without color. There are some good subtexts that I enjoyed as well, and the score was really good, as was the acting. This film was shot in the United States, but the spoken language is Persian. I watched it with subtitles, so if you're on board with all of these things, I'd say give it a watch, as I thought this was really good. So my rating here for A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is going to be an 8 out of 10. And then I also got to watch from the summer series Housebound. This is from 2014. This is written and directed by Gerard Johnstone. This stars Morgana O'Reilly, Rima Tewayata, and Glenn Paul Warrow. This is a comedy horror mystery film that is from New Zealand. It is currently sitting on a 6.8 on IMDb and a 3.4 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being a young woman is forced to return to her childhood home after being placed under house arrest, where she suspects that something evil may be lurking. So this is a film that I checked out originally as part of Movie Club Challenge for over on the podcast Under the Stairs. I didn't know a whole lot about this one coming in, but I had heard some people who had seen it came out, and many of them were speaking pretty highly about it. Now, I am now giving another viewing for T-Puts as part of the summer series now as well. So what I want to start off is that this film is quirky. I really like the structure of Kylie as a character, and now she's our main person portrayed by O'Reilly. There are so many layers to her as well as to the film, and I think that is genius. First, she is a criminal and stuck in the house. That helps to contain it and build tension since she cannot legally leave. Being that she is a criminal, that makes her unreliable, and no one believes her when she's saying that some of these weird things are happening. It doesn't help that she's rude to everybody, so that makes people not want to help her as well. Now, there is a subtle reveal later in the film that she is diagnosed with being bipolar. She claims it was a lie so she could get drugs, but it is on her file, which makes you think that some of the things she might be seeing might not necessarily be real, and that goes with the things that she's hearing also. I will admit, I had trouble getting into this film at first. They establish that this could be a ghost, and then going from there, it seems like a cool concept that she couldn't leave. I don't have any issues anymore with the second viewing, though. I understand what they're building for. Now, there is a reveal that happens at about the midway point that hooked me, and the film really builds tension to a solid conclusion from there. It does still meander a bit, and I feel like it is too long. Now, something I wasn't the biggest fan of is the comedy. It doesn't work for me overall, but there are a few things here and there that do make me chuckle. Now, this doesn't hurt the film, though, in my opinion, though, either. It is played straight for the most part, where the comedy is just there to kind of give it a bit of levity, and that's kind of how I like my horror comedies to be structured. Now, to the acting, I really liked O'Reilly. She pissed me off for the first half of the movie, and I think that's part of the reason I had trouble getting into it at first, as she's such a horrible person that I couldn't stand what she was doing. Now, I will say, though, reflecting on this, I do give her credit because anytime you get a reaction out of me, that's really what I'm looking for most performances. I do also find her attractive, and I think she was a good person to have, you know, so I commend her for that. Now, Weta is funny with how odd she is. She adds something that I think I could see a bit of my mother there. And then we have Wara was solid as well. I think Ross Harper was interesting as his character and really changes the dynamic of the film once he is introduced. Then we have Cameron Rhodes is another character that intrigues me. There's a change that we see with him that I didn't see coming the first time around. And I thought the rest of the cast really just rounded this film out for what was needed. Effects I thought were solid as well. They were done practically, which I really like. There is a scene where someone is stabbed in the leg and it made me cringe for what they do. The blood in the film has good color and consistency. There are some times that they go overboard with it that made me laugh, which I don't mind. And it takes a bit too long, though, to get to some of this, if I'm going to be honest. Something else I want to give credit here would be the cinematography. I think the movie is shot well. Now, something that really didn't stand out to me was the soundtrack. The use of sound, though, I did want to touch on. We hear noises in the walls, which I thought was a good touch. It is unsettling, the feeling that it comes when you think it's ghosts, but then it makes a turn that we end up learning what is really causing it, and that I thought was solid as well. The use of tape recorders is something else I thought was solid, including using a Teddy Ruxpin-like doll that adds a creep factor. So now with that said, this is a movie that the first time I saw it, I liked it, but had my issues. I wasn't feeling the first half until the reveal of the movie. That's when I get sucked in and wanted to see how things would play out. The acting of this film helps. I hated Kylie, but she really does turn it around for me, but I do have to give credit for her to get a reaction out of me. The comedy doesn't necessarily land for me for the most part, but it does make me chuckle. Thought the pacing was a bit off until that reveal, but once it's there, it builds tension to a solid conclusion. The effects were good, the score of the film didn't necessarily stand out, but the use of sound did. I would say this is a solid film overall, and this is one from New Zealand, so I did watch it with subtitles on just because I can sometimes miss some things with the language and everything, so that's something to keep in mind, but you don't necessarily need to watch it like that. But I would say that overall this is an above average movie, and I'm coming in with a 7 out of 10 on Housebound. And for my last mini review this week is going to be Goodnight Mommy. This goes by the original title of Ixen Ixen. This is from 2014. This was co-directed and co-written between Severin Faglia and Veronica Franz. And then this stars Lucas Schwarz, Elias Schwarz, and Susanna Weist. This is a horror mystery thriller film that is from Austria. It is currently sitting on a 6.7 on IMDb and a 3.4 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, twin boys move to a new house with their mother after she has face-changing cosmetic surgery, but under the bandages is someone the boys don't recognize. Now, this movie was originally covered on episode number 17 as a mini review, so I'm not going to go too deeply into this one here, but what I really kind of noticed after the second viewing is that this is just a really interesting type story that's not always the newest, but I like what they do with it here, is that there are little subtle things that if you pay attention throughout the movie make sense to the end. Now, I know in that original review I did state that there was a spoiler that was revealed to me by Jamie as we were talking about this over breakfast where we went to see it, you know, later that day. I don't think that ruined it for me, but I will say as a second viewing, I was really paying a whole lot more attention to everything that was going on. We have these two boys who don't know if their mother is actually their mother or not because she has, I believe it's a nose job, but she had some sort of cosmetic surgery and is under these bandages. Now, the mother is much more strict, and I don't know how much of that is that she's in pain after the surgery, as well as the medication that she's on, but the rules that she's putting down are quite harsh in these boys' eyes, so they must think that it is a different woman who has replaced their mother. Now, we have where, like with Lucas, it seems like the mother is ignoring him, where she's quite brutal and annoyed with different things that Elias is doing. So they end up taking things into their own hand where they torture her, trying to get her to admit to who she is. But Elias has some doubts that the more that they're doing things to their mother, the more that he's wondering if it is actually their mother, where Lucas is the one who's steadfast that it's 100% not her and he can't fall for her lies and everything like that. I do think the movie runs a bit long. For the effects, though, I think they are really good as they go practical with everything that they can. And there's a few points in this movie where it definitely makes me cringe. Now, I do know there's a little bit of CGI at the end with some fire and everything like that. I can be a little bit forgiving there because they don't focus on it too much. And it's, you know, just that little bit there. And what I was kind of getting back to is I think it runs a bit long. The movie does meander a bit after, you know, we kind of get introduced to everything. And it gets a bit repetitive. But I think it does settle in as, you know, the tension starts to ramp up. I also kind of want to bring up, there's this odd scene with some Red Cross people that I'm not necessarily sure why it's there and why they're so just forward with coming into this house. I know it's there to build tension and everything, but that does seem a bit weird. Other than that, I also kind of wanted to say something about the soundtrack and sound design here. I do like at times we do have the soundtrack that'll help to raise tension, but other times we have nothing behind it, and that makes things a little bit more unnerving for me, so I did think that kind of is pretty effective there. I think that's all I really need to kind of delve into here, just to kind of update you with my second viewing of this movie. I still really enjoy it and think it's pretty solid. There's definitely some interesting aspects that are being explored as well. We get a descent into madness and the mistrust through that. As I've said, I thought the acting helps to bring this to life. The effects made me cringe with the realism, and the soundtrack fits for what was needed to help build tension. So for me, I would say that Goodnight Mommy, I'm still sitting on an 8 out of 10 for this movie. So that's all I'm going to do for mini reviews for this week. So what I'm going to go ahead and do is get you over to the trailer of my first featured review. And for my first featured review on this episode is going to be The Son of Dr. Jekyll. This is directed by Seymour Friedman. This comes from the story from Mortimer Bross and Jack Pollexfen. And then uncredited work here was done by Edward Husbeck. And then this stars Lewis Hayward, Jodie Lawrence, and Alexander Knox, while also featuring Lester Matthews, Gavin Muir, Paul Kavanaugh, Reese Williams, Victor Adamson, Patrick Anner, Benita Booth, Matthew Bolton, Hamilton Camp, Claire Carlton, Wheaton Chambers, David Cole, Leslie Dennison, David Dunbar, and Betty Fairfax. This is a crime, horror, romance, sci-fi thriller film that is from the United States. This is currently sitting on a 4.9 on IMDb and a 2.8 on Letterboxd, With our synopsis here being, the son of the notorious Dr. Henry Jekyll is determined to prove that his father's reputation has been unjustly deserved. He sets out to develop his father's formula in order to prove that the brilliant scientist rather than a murderous monster. So this movie that I'll be honest, I didn't know it existed. When I looked into this movie, I figured out that this was a sequel to the John Barrymore Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from 1920. I was curious what they were going to do with this movie since it came out after Universal had their run of sequels to the classic horror films. Now, this isn't from them. This is actually a Columbia film, but I know that, you know, Universal had that run, so I was wondering if this was going to be in the same vein or do something just a little bit different. But before I jump into the movie itself, let me do some featured notes here. So to kick us off with our director of Friedman, he had 19 films that he helmed. It looked like he did a lot of, like, crime, film noir type stuff with the actor of Warner Baxter. But this is the only horror film that he did and the only one that I've seen so far. Now moving to the writers, our first one here is Bross, has 9 credits. Of them, this is the only one that was horror and the only one that I've seen. And then co-writer of Pollexfen is one that I brought up recently as he wrote The Man from Planet X. Now this is the second film from him that I have now seen. Then to our actors here, our star of Hayward has 45 films that he was in. Of them, 2 are in horror, with this one being the first one. The only other one that he was in was much later in his career with Terror at the Wax Museum from 1973. I haven't seen that one, so this is the only movie that I have seen so far. Then his co-star of Lawrence was in 10 films. This is her only horror film, the only one that I've seen. Then we have Knox. He has 68 credits. I have seen him in The Vikings, which isn't a horror film, but this movie here is his first in genre. He would follow it up with Alias John Preston, The Damned, The Psychopath, and Holocaust 2000. As he was working into the 1970s, I have not seen any of those other 4 films at this time, though. So then for this movie here, we start at the end of the original one. Mr. Hyde, who in this movie, they're, you know, re-filming everything, is portrayed by Hayward as he flees from a mob of people. He makes his way into the laboratory of Dr. Jekyll in an attempt to change back from the form that he currently is in. Before he can, a torch is thrown through the window and it causes a fire. Mr. Hyde cannot get out and he goes up to the 3rd floor where he falls to his death. Now looking over his body are his 2 friends of Dr. Curtis Lanyon, who is portrayed by Knox, and Sir John Utterson, who is portrayed by Matthews. They're called to an apartment by an Inspector Gray, who is an uncredited role by Bolton. This place belonged to a young woman that Mr. Hyde was seeing. There is a baby with this former actress who was killed by Mr. Hyde. Now she is the mother and then Mr. Hyde is the father. The 2 men decide that they're going to keep the child. Dr. Lanyon states that he isn't in the right place to take a child where John is married and they're having trouble having children at the time. So he decides to end up taking the child on, but they're going to help do stuff together. Now the movie then shifts us from 1860 to 1890. Edward Jekyll is an adult who is seeing John's niece of Lynn Utterson, portrayed by Lawrence. We get an interesting scene here where an editor of a newspaper by the name of Richard Daniels, portrayed by Meir, is talking to one of his reporters and they learn the history of Edward and about him getting kicked out of the Royal Science Academy from a letter that is delivered to them. We don't see who delivered it though. It then takes us over there to kind of see Edward as he's packing up and he proposes to Lynn. We also get to see Dr. Lanyon speaking with John. They are trying to devise a way to convince Edward to allow Dr. Lanyon to continue to handle the estate of Dr. Jekyll. Now, their reasoning behind it is because they know once the press and the, you know, people realize who Edward is actually the son of, they think it can make his life very difficult. And their fear is that, you know, Edward learned who he truly is because as far as he knows, he doesn't know his last name at the time as, you know, Jekyll as well. When they approach the subject with him, he isn't one to shy away from controversy. He instead wants to clear his name of his father. This leads them to getting a key from Dr. Lanyon and going to his father's lab. A constable believes that him is a trespasser. Edward clears up the problem and he sees a blonde woman outside, you know, kind of drawing a commotion to the house. Much later on, this woman also interrupts him while he's reading a book as she's calling out for help. Now, this book is written by his father as well. But when Edward goes to find help from a police officer, the woman is gone. And this constable thinks that Edward's eyes are playing tricks on him, you know, reading in the dark and staying up as late as he is. Edward is given the money from his father's estate and goes about fixing up the houses as well as the laboratory. Dr. Lanyon stops by to help and brings him the notes from his father's experiment. This gives him the opportunity of performing the same experiment to show how brilliant his father is. What happens here, though, is it ends up leads him to have sleepless nights and grieve to get it right. We see that Dr. Lanyon might be secretly helping him behind the scenes. The problem, though, is that this could lead to him turning into a monster like his father, and when random acts of violence around London start to happen, and especially pretty close to this laboratory, all of the evidence points toward Edward. Now, that's where I'm going to leave my recap here. Where I want to start is that I think we get an interesting story here that is a follow-up to this classic silent film. What I like is that we are doing something similar while also doing its own thing. Edward is following in his father's footsteps. We aren't getting a mad scientist movie here necessarily. We know that Edward is a good guy, he's just a bit outspoken. You don't need to see that original movie to enjoy this one, and I think a lot of that is the fact that it is a classic story. I bring that up here for the fact that everyone knows about what Mr. Hyde did. For this movie, Edward wants to clear his father's name to show that he wasn't the monster that we know. Going from him wanting to prove that, we also have these reporters and citizens of London bothering Edward. The reporters want him to be the monster that his father was because it's good, you know, publicity, and it's good, it's easier to sell newspapers with that. They even rile him up to get a reaction out of him. I find this interesting commentary to what we see from the news now. Bad news sells, so that's what they're pushing. The citizens are also interesting as they fear Edward because of who his father is. They assume that he must be the same. They go into the mob mentality multiple times in this movie, and I think that's an interesting commentary as there as well, where they're doing stuff that's illegal and, you know, destroying property, setting fires and everything. I mean, they're pretty much rioting, but it's mob mentality, so nobody feels that they're actually guilty because they did it as a group. So with that out of the way, I want to go next to where this movie, you know, is really about. Edward has many sleepless nights trying to recreate his father's experiment. We get to see that he does succeed with a little help from Dr. Lanyon. He decides to do a demonstration, but when he fails, he is bummed. Edward does go to visit a family who lived in the apartment with his mother while she was, you know, there and everything, and to learn more about who his mother was. There is an attack on a boy who broke a window in the Jekyll lab. Edward is a suspect, and this turns him into needing to clear his name. I found this to be quite interesting, to be honest, because at first he's trying to clear his father's, but now he also has to clear his own. This ends up becoming a different variation that even though we think people are good, they can also harbor a dark side that makes them do things that we wouldn't necessarily expect. So I kind of like them also taking the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde story and then doing, you know, a little bit shifting of it. Then the last thing I'll go over would be some plot holes. I don't believe that Dr. Jekyll was becoming Mr. Hyde long enough for him to have a baby to be born at the time of his death. I can overlook this, but it does change things to allow it to work for this movie. I'm also not sure how the movie is resolved makes complete sense. There are some liberties taken to agree that a person is guilty, you know, that's who it's believed to be guilty now. Again, it doesn't ruin the movie, but it's just things that I did notice. So I think next I'll go to the acting. Hayward is solid as Edward. We briefly takes on the roles of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde as well, but Edward is the character he is mostly. I like how he's concerned with his heritage as it gives him a purpose. I feel bad for him though, as he's framed for committing these crimes. Knowing that this is, you know, a Jekyll Hyde movie, it makes me wonder if he is behind it or not. Because we don't get to see the attacks actually happening. If we do, it's also not until much later that there could be another person involved. His appearance is solid, and I think that Knox does a solid job as Dr. Lanyon and Matthews as John. Lawrence is interesting to me as this character of Lynn, as she disappears for a good portion of this movie. I think they could have done a bit more to flesh her out, as she's really just there to support Edward. Aside from that, I thought the rest of the cast is solid in directing our character to where they end up. Then the last thing I'll go over would be the cinematography, soundtrack, and the effects. Now for the former, I think it's fine. We don't get a lot in the way of camera movements or angles, but I don't have any issues there either. We do get a transformation scene, and I was thoroughly impressed there, especially because I know there's movies that came out a decade after this that don't have one. They use time-lapse, and I can appreciate that. The brief look of Mr. Hyde does work for me, and then as for the soundtrack, I thought it fit for what the movie needed. Now, there's really only one bit of trivia here on the IMDb page, so I'll do that before I close this out. Now, when Edward is altered by his father's formula, makeup artist Clay Campbell used colored filters to affect the change. He applied red makeup to Hayward and then passed two color filters, a red and bluish green, in front of the lens. The makeup looked normal under the red filter, but then turned dark and scary as the camera shot through the blue-green one. Makeup artist Wally Westmore used the same technique in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in 1931, which I find to be pretty interesting that you could do such an easy thing here to actually simulate that. I digress. So then in conclusion here, I actually enjoyed this movie more than I thought I would. I think we have an interesting idea here to continue on from the story in the original classic. It brings a lot of aspects while doing its own story to the point where you don't need to see it, since you probably know enough about the tale just from it being passed around and it being classic. The acting is solid, where Hayward and Knox carry this, with the rest of them, you know, just directing those two characters where they end up. The cinematography is fine. The effects that we get are solid, and the soundtrack fits for what they needed. Overall, I'd say this is an above-average movie, in my opinion. I'm coming in higher than most, as it just seemed to click with me. So my rating here for The Son of Dr. Jekyll is going to be a 7.5 out of 10. Now, I'm not going to do a spoiler section. I don't really think I need that here for this movie, so what I'm going to go ahead and do is get you over to the trailer of my second featured review.
How is this possible? Do you know what this place is?
Your mother, Angela, she's our patient.
I've been out of touch with her for a very long time.
Oh my God.
Her mind is very active in the simulation.
Simulation?
She went on a homicidal rampage. This is your chance to ask her why.
Mom?
Carly, you have to go. You have to go.
Guys, please let me out. Go. Can you hear me?
You have to go.
Guys!
What are we doing?
No. Just wait.
Are you sure that you haven't been having any hallucinations outside of the simulation?
And for my second feature review on this episode here is going to be Demonic. This is from here in 2021. This is written and directed by Neil Blomkamp. This stars Carly Pope, Chris William Martin, and Michael J. Rogers, along with Natalie Blott, Terry Chen, Candice McClure, Jason Tremblay, Quentin Boisclair, Derek Versteeg, Christopher Wardrop, and Andrea Auger. This is a horror film. And I also think there might be a little bit of sci-fi in this, in my opinion, and the country of origin is Canada. This is currently sitting on a 4.3 on IMDb and a 1.9 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being a young woman unleashes terrifying demons when supernatural forces at the root of a decades-old rift between mother and daughter are ruthlessly revealed. So this is a movie I first heard about going to the Gateway Film Center. The trailer was being shown, so I knew that this was going to be shown there. I didn't get the chance to see it in the theater due to scheduling issues, but it was one that I added to my list of films to check out for 2021, since I am a fan of the writer-director here of Blomkamp. I'll be honest, I did see some people who saw this before me bringing it down, so that did make me a little bit leery about checking this out. So before I get into the movie itself, let me do some featured notes on the key people here. I'll start off with the director of Blomkamp, who has 30 films. Of them, I've seen two. His first was District 9, which isn't horror, but it is somewhat adjacent to me. He does have 8 credits in the genre. 4 are shorts, and it looks like they're all part of a series called Cooking with Bill. Now, he does have another short as well that is Raqqa, and it also seems to be part of the District 9 mythology, and I think he actually has a couple more shorts, because this is actually Demonic being his feature-length horror film. As for a writer, he has 18 credits, much of the same for what I have seen. Now, moving to our actors, I'll start with Pope. She has 56 credits. Of them, I've seen 3, and part of another one. The first that I have seen her in is Orange County, and then 2 for the Money. I've also seen part of Snow Day, which is a kids movie. She has worked with Blomkamp a lot and has 11 credits in horror. Her first is I've Been Waiting for You from 1998 and then Disturbing Behavior from the same year. The only horror film that I have seen is this one here. Then I'll go to Blot. She has 13 credits. She was in District 9 and the Poseidon Adventure from 2005, which is the not-so-good one, and I've seen both of those. I've also seen her in Doomsday, which is horror-adjacent. Now, she has 2 credits in the genre, technically, with Red Water, which I haven't seen, and now this movie here. As for Martin, he has 26 acting credits. I've seen 3 of them. He was in the horror-adjacent movie of Buried with Ryan Reynolds that I do enjoy. Now, in horror, he has 3 credits. I've seen him in Alien vs. Predator Requiem, and then this one here. Now, he also has worked with Blomkamp on a short of called Firebase. Then the last person to look at is Rogers. He has 20 credits, 9 are horror. His first was Children of the Corn Revelation, which I think is the 7th installment. He followed that up with Hellraiser Hellseeker, which I have seen that one as well. He was also in the ABCs of Death and now this. I did want to point out 2 things here. This guy was also in Beyond the Black Rainbow, which is on a short list for me to check out because I haven't yet. Now, all of these actors have also worked with Blomkamp prior with either a feature or a short, so it makes sense as a little bit of trivia that I have for you that I'm going to share next. This was filmed secretly in Canada over the course of the COVID-19 pandemic, which actually makes a whole lot of sense because if you know all these people, you could get them around to film stuff when you have the time and you guys are all, you know, medically cleared to do so if they were, you know, following protocols. I'm not going to say if they were or weren't, just saying. Now, for this movie, we start in a field with tall grass. Carly, who is portrayed by Pope, is walking through it, and she can hear a woman's voice calling out for her for help. She approaches a large building and goes inside. She finds the woman who is calling out to her as Angela, who is portrayed by Blot. Now, this turns out to be her mother. Even from this early scene, we see that there are tensions between Angela as she asks if she knows what her daughter is standing in and tosses a lighter at her, starting a fire. This turns out to be a dream. Carly is estranged from her mother and has moved on with her life the best she can. She goes about her day when she gets a text message from Martin, who's portrayed by Martin. She hesitates to answer it when Sam, who's portrayed by McClure, calls. Carly and her are best friends, and Sam has moved back to the area for work. Carly agrees to come to see the place that she is staying and have a glass of wine and some pizza, but she cannot stay long. Later that night, Martin sends another text message. It is a time and a place for them to meet on the following day. She does agree to this, and we learn later that Martin, Sam, and Carly were all friends growing up. Carly's mother went on a killing spree, and then Martin went a bit crazy. Now, Carly couldn't deal with this at that time, and, you know, Sam and Carly turned their backs on him when he started, you know, acting this way. Over a drink, Martin reveals that he went to a focus group for a sleep study. Carly's mother was there. They are trying to get in touch with Carly, but Martin refused to give her information to them. That night, they do get in touch with her, and she agrees to meet with them. The man who greets her is Michael, who's portrayed by Rogers. Along with Daniel, who's portrayed by Chen, they are conducting an experiment. Angela has locked-in syndrome that was believed to start after a brain injury in prison. She was harming herself during this time as well. It has her in a pseudo-coma now, so this company of Therapol was able to get her released into their care to look into it and see if there is a cure. They focus on brain mapping amongst other experiments. The reason they sought out Carly was to go into a simulation with her mother that she is currently locked in. They want her to ask questions to better understand her condition. She agrees to do this, but once she meets her mother in a memory, she tells her all the things that she's been harboring for all these years. Angela understands and wants her to leave. Michael points out that she didn't ask all of the questions about her mother's condition that they needed answered. They want her to go back in to help them. Carly is leery and refuses at first. She does change her mind, though. The simulation isn't necessarily what it seems. Angela is able to tell Carly things, but Angela isn't in complete control. Carly realizes that the second memory is the building where all the troubles began and the one of Carly's nightmares. Angela might not be fully to blame, and Therapol might not be exactly who they say they are. Martin might not also be completely crazy either. So that's where I'm going to leave my recap. And then to shift over, we have some interesting aspects of this movie that I'm not surprised to see that Blomkamp has done movies like District 9 and Elysium, as he does an excellent job of taking science fiction ideas and then incorporating them into a grounded movie. That is where I want to start. What gets things going in this movie is a technology that Therapol has. Angela is in a coma and they're able to tap into her brain and render whatever memory she is currently in in a simulation. It reminded me of playing The Sims with how it looks. Carly is able to tap in and join her. What makes this better is that the simulation isn't perfect. Part of this is it's from memories and is a like a dream. Not all the details are there, but enough that you recognize it. This idea that they're using also works for me, as we get a lot of dream sequences in this movie. I'm usually totally against this, but I'm forgiving due to the simulation, and what I'll get into next also uses this to mess with its victims. So what I mean there is that we have a supernatural aspect here. The demon, I don't recall ever getting a name, but I think it's kind of cool looking, as it has this skull of a raven on it. Now, it's much bigger because it's, you know, more human, or, I mean, a little bit even more monstrous size. Now, Martin is our researcher, as he's been plagued by this creature for a long time. This has pushed him into reading religious texts and mythology. I like that he gives us enough without completely being able to explain it all. I'm a sucker for this, so I can always use a bit more as well. We are getting an interesting take on a possession film through all of this as well. Now, I do have some gripes here. I'm not going to spoil what it is, but there is a reveal about the truth behind Therapol. I'm fine with it to an extent. I think it goes too far, though, and I don't think all of what they give us is needed. The movie also runs too long. It is coming in around 105 minutes or so, where I think 15 minutes could have been trimmed and it would have tightened this movie up. I'm also thinking that some of the things that they added that don't work for me is part of what bogs this down. I don't want you to think this movie is boring, as some people say, but it does meander still a bit for me. So in the move away from the story, we'll go next to the acting. I think that Pope is solid as our lead here. She has an interesting role to take on. Her mother committed horrible acts when Carly was a young adult. This forced her to grow up, and she has to deal with angry people lashing out at her for what her mother did. I think the performance feels like someone who is harboring a lot of anger and is faced with a side to things that she didn't know about. Martin is fine, but I think he comes off a bit wooden, if I'm going to be honest. I did like Rogers, Blatt, and Chen. Rogers taking on this role of Michael is interesting. I don't trust him from the beginning, and it just gets worse as we go. Then McClure was bland for me as well. She doesn't have a big part, so there is that, so I can't hold it too much against the movie itself. Overall, I'm still positive on the acting as a whole, though. So the last thing I'll go over would be the effects, cinematography, and the soundtrack. I've already said that I like the look of this creature and what they do with the simulation. The blood we get looks good. We get an interesting scene with Carly and Sam, as I'm assuming this was using CGI that was quite creepy. Both worked for me. Now, the cinematography is solid as well. I had no issues there, and the soundtrack is a bit subdued, but it also doesn't take me out of the movie either, which is really kind of my biggest thing with soundtracks, is I either love them or it takes me out of the movie completely. So if you come in the middle there, I'm, you know, completely forgiving of that. So then in conclusion here, I think this isn't as bad as some people have said, but I do have my issues. I like the lore that we're using here and incorporating the sci-fi elements into it. There are some things that have been added that we don't need, and it does bog the pacing down for me. The acting is solid for the most part, and the effects are good, as is the cinematography. The soundtrack doesn't stand out, but it also works for what they need. Overall, I'd say this is just over average for me, but it's lacking too many things for me to go much higher than that at this time. And I just had two bits of trivia before I give my rating and then move on. This is the first Blomkamp film not to feature Charlito Copley or have cinematography done by Trent Oplak. Use a technique called volumetric capture for a portion of the film. I'm assuming that's what the simulation stuff is what we're getting. So my rating here for Dynamic from 2021 here is going to be a 6 out of 10. I'm not going to do a spoiler section, as I don't feel like I need to delve into too much more than what I've already given to you. So what I'm going to go ahead and do is get you over to a very brief break before I close out the show. And I'd like to welcome you back one last time. And then just to close everything out here for episode number 98, if you'd like to get in touch with me with anything you'd like to have read on the show or any sort of feedback or anything like that, you can send me an email at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. If you'd like to read any of the reviews for anything on this episode or any of the past episodes, that's Reviews of the Dead, and that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, it's David Mishkin Garrett Jr. On Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, where I'll be posting any of my horror or non-horror reviews, that'll be DavidOSU is my username over there. And then if you'd like to follow my Instagram pages, it's DavidOSU87, and Journey with a Cinephile, all one word, is the Journey with a Cinephile Instagram, and I will have all the links for all of those in the show notes just to make it easier on you. And the last thing I'd ask, if you could go ahead and hit subscribe so you never miss a new episode, that would be greatly appreciated. And on top of that, if you're able to rate and review just so I can figure out what I'm doing that you like and what I'm doing that you don't like, as well as get to more listeners out there, that would just be greatly appreciated on my part. So then for the next episode is going to be another Odyssey Through the Ones, where I'm going to be pairing up a classic horror story, which I believe is on Netflix. I think it's an Italian horror film that is released here in 2021. And then the other movie is going to be Death is a Number, as I'm whittling down the 1951 films. And then on top of that, I'll also have some other, you know, horror movies that I'll be sprinkling in there. Probably a lot more of those Summer Challenge Series movies from the podcast Under the Stairs as well. Don't really know if there's anything else that I need to get you up to speed with. I think that kind of shores everything up. About to be a busy time here as October is looming. So I won't take up any more time here. So what I will say then in closing is that whatever you do today, I hope you're safe in doing it and have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr. and I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening, and what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.